Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, they don't like me. It's time for Mustache Scene TV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century from I Love Lucy the News Radio. I'm your TV guide, Brett White, and I'm also a reporter-producer for Decider.com. This week, I'm joined once again by returning guest and fledgling comic book author, Paul Montgomery. Hello, Paul.
That's me. Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's been a very long time.
It's funny because I've actually been watching, we've been playing Taxi on Hulu at work, so and that's what we talked about the last time, I believe.
Yeah. So, well, you also work in a garage, so is that like, I mean, is that like doctors watching Saint Elsewhere?
It's very Mayberry in our little village. I live in Philadelphia, but we work just outside of Philly. It's family business, and I expressed on Twitter this week that the regular – it's sort of like Cheers without the alcohol.
Yeah.
And everyone's Cliff. Like all of the regulars are Cliff Clavin at his worst, at his least adorable. As a writer, it's a pretty fun place to work just to observe – for the people watching.
Yeah.
The behavior, the people who come in and ask for me to put gas in their tires. I said, no, ma'am, I don't think you want that. I don't think you want gas in your tires.
I mean, you should do it once just to see what it does.
But it's happened more than once, and it's different people ask for it, and so that's some weird phenomenon, but anyways.
I mean, I feel like this right here is a sitcom I want to see. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, sitcoms that have happened at, like, auto repair places.
Taxi has the cars, and then Latka is a mechanic, but they don't they don't go into that too much. But I don't know.
In the past, you know, year and a half since you've been on, you did publish a comic book.
That's true. We came out. So me and my co-writer David Ocampo, we wrote this script, or we wrote part of a script for something called The Margins about 4 years ago. And that has been in the works with artist Amanda Donahue for all the time. And we have great publishers in Fanbase Press. It's a wonderful couple out of Los Angeles. And so it's just a small press kind of deal and a small printing. But you can get that at themarginscomic.com. And it's very like meta about creators and imagination and sort of that cool world idea of what if your imaginings start to come to life. And there's a lot about gatekeeping in there. So that's sort of the personal bit of it.
Nice.
And you can get that. And you can also get it on Comixology. It's just $10 and or themarginscomic.com through Fanbase Press. It's also on Amazon. We're a third party seller there. That's fun too. So that was a 4-year project. And then right after that, we had a 4-month project where my friend Connor from ifanboy.com, where I use the podcast, approached me and Dave about this video game property, Dreadnought, which is available on Steam. And they also had their own launcher as well. And it's a space combat game. And he said, hey, you want to make a comic about this video game that doesn't quite have a narrative to it? And so we had a lot of ability to work with the games team
Oh, wow.
to develop some story stuff. And we did sort of this one shot called Dreadnought Legends, and we called it Ghosts of Sinley Bay, which is sort of your starting point where you learn how to pilot the ships, and that's where all the space pirates hang out. So it was this really fun opportunity to tell kind of a Star Wars story.
Yeah, that's super rad.
Yeah, so it's like this space pirate kind of thing. And we got to tell a really fun story with an artist, Priscilla Petraits, who Dave met through the DC Comics workshops. He did the writing workshop,
and she was
the artist workshop. So he knew her from that, and she was fantastic to work with, Brazilian artist. And then I got a weird text one day from Connor that said, "Hey, what if Bill Sienkiewicz did the cover?" And I was, "Is there another Bill Sienkiewicz?" It seems like I would, like, if I was coming into the comics industry as a Bill Sienkiewicz, I would be like Bill F. Sienkiewicz, or like, or I would make
William Sienkiewicz.
The Bill Sienkiewicz, like, oh, from Elektra and the X-Men books.
New Mutants,
like, oh my God. And so one of my favorite artists, and so to get an opportunity where he's going to come on board and draw a cover with characters that we created.
That's rad.
You know, it's a licensed, you know, thing. It's like those characters are characters that we came up with.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of nuts as a comics fan for all these years to... And that's my first single issue cover is a Bill Sienkiewicz cover. So we'll see where we go from here in 2019. But I'm excited to do some more projects. We'll see where the future takes us. But we've been having fun, me and Dave, doing these books together. So we'll see what happens next.
Off to a good start.
Yeah.
Now from Space Pirates to the exact opposite of that. I would say
I'm wondering why did you call me on for this particular episode?
This week we'll be traveling to December 22nd, 1966. Murderer's Row ruled the box office. Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys topped the charts. And ABC aired the That Girl episode, Christmas and the Hard Luck Kid. Paul, you must have seen Christmas and the Hard Luck Kid before today.
I was going to say not the first airing. I wasn't around then, but I believe I'd seen this before. Maybe once before. It's not
what is
one
your
that
history?
I revisit every kid. It's not part of my Christmas tradition, let's say. It's not like, it's not the holidays until
right.
I see that girl episode with Linus in it.
Yeah, that – So, like, That Girl was always a second-tier old show for me growing up because it was a TV Land show. I don't think it ever aired on Nick at Night. And so there's, like, the Nick at Night wave that I was obsessed with for as long as I can remember. And then there was, like, when I was in middle school, I think, is when TV Land launched. And when we finally got TV Land, it was like, oh, my God, what are all these shows? And then I was obviously gay because I was, like, a middle schooler that was obsessed with watching That Girl. Mm-hmm. Like in the summer I was super into watching this show, but then like I fell off of it and I did not watch it until a couple years ago, I think probably 2014 2015 when I noticed that it was on Hulu, which Hulu has a stealth library of just old shows. Like the original Dennis the Menace sitcom is on there,
right.
They don't advertise that. If you just keep searching around, you'll find it eventually. And I put on Christmas and the Hard Luck Kid, and it has become a Christmas essential for me, definitely, over the past, like, 3 or 4 years.
There's no snow in it, Brett. There's no snow.
There is very pointedly some rain.
Yes. Yeah.
So this week on Must Have Seen TV, we'll be talking about the That Girl episode, Christmas and the Hard Luck Kid. It is the 16th episode of Season 1 and was written by James L. Brooks and directed by John Ehrman. Here's how Hulu describes the episode. As her shift as an elf for a department store Santa Claus concludes, Anne tells Donald about her stint as a teacher in a boarding school trying to bring good tidings and joy to a boy who won't be able to go home for Christmas. Paul, how accurate is that description?
Well, that I'm sure.
And that's it, basically.
that's kind of, yeah.
That's a good sell. It's a good pitch for this episode, because that is, I think it leans too heavily on the department store part, because that's very
much just a framing device, and you don't really have many adventures there. No.
And this also, like, Donald and Anne, her name is also Anne Marie, which
right
always
first name Anne, last name Marie.
Yeah, and when her father or mother are on there, they are Mr. and Mrs. Marie. It always just reminds me of how that's not a last name. Like, I don't think that's an actual last name.
It's weird for me because my well, not weird, but it was remarkable to me because my fourth grade teacher was named Miss Marie.
Oh.
And her last name was so her full name was Marie Robb, but for some reason she went, but it was like spelled oddly. It was like R-A-A-B-E, I think. So I don't know. They just always referred to her as Miss Marie. And so seeing a teacher referred to as Miss Marie by her kids was kind of nostalgic for me.
This episode hits all the corners. So yeah, the episode opens with Donald in line, played by Ted Bessel, in line for Santa. And he's making small talk with a woman that is standing behind him who has a gift she's there to deliver to one of Santa's helpers. So the thing that I think is really fun about this show is that every cold open ends with that girl.
Mm-hmm. Someone saying that girl.
And the camera zooming in on Anne Marie, on Marlo Thomas.
She and my son Tommy once spent Christmas together.
Oh. Which one of Santa's helpers is that?
Over there. That girl.
It's a fun idea.
Yeah. The creation of this show is something I'm very interested in. I should have read up more on. I know it was created by two of the writers from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Right.
So it has a pedigree there. And Marlo Thomas is herself the daughter of Danny Thomas,
mm-hmm.
who is one of those like sitcom royalty people.
I was going to say, yeah, sitcom royalty is, I think, not an unfair way.
I mean, the Andy Griffith Show started as a spinoff of the Danny Thomas Show. And then the Andy Griffith Show then begat, Gomer Pyle and like all the Mayberry shows.
Mayberry RFD.
Yeah, starring Ken Berry. Oh, the late, great Ken Berry. Oh, yes. I love Ken Berry. It's also considered like it's so obviously a predecessor to the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Mm-hmm.
It already just because like this episode was written by James L. Brooks, who was one of the co-creators of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then also they have the same haircut. Like they, you both got that the 60s flip do.
Single woman, like going about her career.
Yeah,
it's not about catching that man and finding domestic bliss.
Right.
It's just about being yourself I would say before its time, but also very timely. I think even if you look at the credit sequence for that girl, like she's just running around New York and having adventures, and like you can see how that evolves into the Mary Tyler Moore Show opening as well.
Yeah, where she's running around Minneapolis. Yeah, it's very, very similar.
And if you haven't seen it, it's sort of like the abridged Perfect Strangers opening.
Yeah.
Not the full one where we get like the full story from where they're coming from, but like but one person instead of buddies, cousins.
Yeah, yeah. Like even Donald, her co-star is hardly even in the opening credits. I even think that the later ones he's not in at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, this show is very much about that girl.
I don't like Donald.
He's not why you watch the show.
Donald just tousling the hair of these kids in line, not even knowing who they are.
Yeah.
Like at first it was like, wait, does he, because it had been a while since I've watched it. I was like, does he have kids of his own or like they're like his little brother or sister or something like that? And then you find out that he has no idea who they are. He just assumes that they're this woman's children that he's talking to, and then we find out that
they're not even hers, they're just
children unattended in line waiting for Santa Claus, and he's just touching their heads.
Well, I mean, even to continue the Donald bashing, when we come back from the opening credits, so like Anne takes him off to the side just like talk to him because he's come to visit her at work, and he says something like, he actually says out loud, "No Santa Claus," like there's no Santa Claus, and then Anne's reaction to that is like this, what? Which makes me so like on two levels. First of all, you're saying that in a department store in the Santa Claus department, like don't go around blabbing that there's no Santa Claus.
Right.
Second of all, it always fascinates me when sitcoms that are ostensibly for the family go on
do
and
that.
Blow up Santa's spot, because it happens so regularly. And it's really a toss-up whether or not the episode at the end of the episode is going to come down on the side of like, wait a second, that guy with a beard, I hear sleigh bells, you know? Because like the Full House, the Full House episode that I discussed last year ends with Stephanie getting hardcore proof that Santa exists, and then they don't bring that up again ever. And I'm like, man, if I spent a Christmas and found out that Santa Claus was fucking real, like, I would never shut up about this. Every year, would psychological damage.
If Urkel can arrive in your backyard on a jetpack, then I think canonically Santa Claus is real.
Yeah, the TGIF universe is filled with flights of fancy. Mm-hmm. So this is when Anne like has to tell the story about like why this random mom is there, and even Donald's like, so like her son that you're friends with is like this tall, and she's like, no, more like this tall, and she like brings his hand down lower because he's an 8-year-old. He's now 11, but so we flash back to the story that she tells 3 years ago when she was a teacher at a boarding school.
You don't want to talk about this gift at all first?
Wait, what is the gift that he comes to bring her?
It's the gift from
the
mother.
Woman. The mother gives her a
who
gift,
is a
right.
horrible person.
Oh yeah, yeah.
As we learn later, but
you don't know it at this point.
Is it like a Hamburglar shirt?
Yeah. Yeah.
But Anne seems delighted by it. And it's no, but it's like it's this tiny shirt it's like a long sleeve, you know, not a blouse, but like a long sleeve crew neck shirt that has like black and white stripes on it. And I was like, "Oh, a Hamburglar shirt. Great." Thanks for giving up your holiday, and well, we'll get into it.
Yeah. So basically, Anne worked at a boarding school. I'm going to assume as a drama teacher is what because like she leaves to go be an actress, and also we first see her as she is welcoming all the kids off the stage of the Christmas pageant.
Mm-hmm.
So my assumption is she's probably like a drama teacher there. That makes sense.
So this is 3 years earlier. So is this canonically the earliest like That Girl adventure?
Probably.
And she's relating it, or are there other episodes where she tells stories from, hey, this thing happened 2 years ago?
Maybe. I don't know, because I've not seen that many. There's also a Paul Lynde one that I've seen where he plays a shoe salesman.
I just think it's fascinating that within the first season there's a hey, this happened 3 years ago, and I don't know that there's necessarily any reason it couldn't just be now, except that they don't have other episodes where she's a teacher,
right? Yeah,
like, but like I don't know.
For the week like she could have. She could have been like subbing as the drama teacher over the holiday at a New York school. I mean, maybe it's because she lives in Manhattan, and the writers were like, "Well, we have to get her out of Manhattan because it's like part of the charm." I think of this episode is it being so remote,
mm-hmm.
and being very like secluded and like kind of like cavernous and yet cozy, right. Cavernous yet cozy. So maybe that was the reason to get into James L. Brooks's head.
And it's also fascinating because, and not just the flashback, but when we actually get to meet Anne in this episode when she's talking with Donald off to the side. You're like, if you hadn't been watching these episodes in a row, like me, I just came to watch this one episode after having not watched them for a while, remembering, oh yeah, Marlo Thomas, she sounds like she's 40 at least in these episodes. And then, you know, she looks like Audrey Hepburn, like in the intro. And then all of a sudden she opens her mouth and it's like, oh, right, the cigarettes.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I always like pointing out that, so Marlo Thomas, you know, in 30 years from this episode airing, will be playing Rachel Green's mother on Friends. And it's so interesting because, like, Anne Marie and Rachel Green are so similar. Like,
she's like a prototype of that.
Yeah, you can view Friends as the Rachel show because she is the one that, like, in the pilot breaks off her wedding, comes in, like, wearing a wedding dress. Like, she's the one that has the inciting incident that starts off the series, and she grows over the 10 seasons. And it's such great casting, you know, of them to look at, like, who's, like, a precursor to this? Oh, obviously Marlo Thomas. And then what I also love is in the season 3 Thanksgiving episode, Phoebe is wearing a That Girl t-shirt, so it's like... Mm. Everything is connected. So one of the kids that comes off stage is a little boy dressed as a tree named Tommy Phillips, I do believe. And as soon as he says the word tree, if you're obsessed with Christmas, It will ping.
If you're a human being.
Oh, my God. It will ping.
In the Western world.
So many alarms will go off that this is the voice of fucking Linus.
Tommy, aren't you going to take off your costume?
Yeah, but it was fun being a tree.
Yeah.
From all of the 60s. I think all of the 60s Charlie Brown specials. But
pretty much. It was like he's at that. I was like, that's at least the Linus from the Christmas special.
Yes, he's a year older. That's it. Like, the Christmas special came out in 65, and this is 66.
Yeah, so I was like, at least that. And so I had to check IMDb, obviously, and then it was like they list, like, all of them. And I feel like they shuffled those child actors around. And it was always cool that the Peanuts specials had kids playing, you know, like actual kids.
Yeah, it really adds a charm to it to hear, like, I think what was probably a seven-year-old saying all that Linus.
It's amazing that this is Linus. Like, there have been multiple Charlie Browns and multiple Lucys, but and there are some more iconic Lucys than others, but as you will know from watching other sitcoms, but I think I was like, that's Linus. Like, I don't even have to look it up. I mean, I'm going to look it up later just to figure out the years and everything and see how many he did. But I was like, that is definitive. I would know that lisp anywhere.
Yeah, I freaked out the first time that I watched it and did it. I mean, like, you sent me a Twitter DM of just like, Linus.
Yep, I was like, that's Linus.
I mean, this is also 100% why I wanted you to do this episode is because of this kid. And I will say, I think I love this episode as much as I do almost specifically because it has Linus in it.
Okay.
Like, I think, like, that the Peanuts Christmas special is the greatest piece of Christmas pop culture to ever exist.
Oh my.
I mean, do you what else is there?
I mean, you got your Rankin and Bass stuff. You got your Rudolph specials and everything like that.
Oh, I thought you said RuPaul specials, and then I realized you said Rudolph specials, but you know, either way.
Not necessarily part of my childhood, but I'm sure part of other people's childhood. Sure. You got It's a Wonderful Life, but I think it's super iconic. It's definitely up there in the top three.
Yeah, and to hear that voice and to also like put a face to the voice and also have it also be like, that's also Linus. Like, I think Tommy Phillips feels a lot like a Linus in a way. He has some real, I mean, one of the very first things he says, so like in this first conversation that he has with Anne, which feels like maybe the first conversation they've ever had one-on-one, which is also kind of interesting that she's apparently like instructed them in doing this pageant where he plays a tree. She compliments him on his swaying, and he was like, no, actually it was just the pine needles, like I was itching. And everyone loves the swaying too. The swaying comes up multiple times. But in this first conversation is where he brings up that he's like, no, she's like, aren't you like excited about Christmas? And he says, like, I'm waiting to see what goes wrong. Which is so heartbreaking. I guess he's actually Charlie Brown.
That's
not
a bit Charlie Brown.
He's Charlie Brown. But he talks about how he's like never had a good Christmas because bum bum bum, his mother is an actress and they are always on set for Christmas.
I mean, at this point, the kid's old enough that he could be traveling with her.
Yeah. It does honestly feel like the only reason he's in a boarding school is because his parents are actors. Because I get the impression, they say his mother's still in the film, but later on they say like his parents, I don't know, it feels like he's the child of maybe two actors. Because if only his mother is an actor, then his father should be with him.
Right.
Oh, God. So like, yeah, they're interesting parents. We'll say that.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And it makes you like, you know, you don't see that woman again, probably for good reason. in the episode, like, you don't see her in the, like, they don't bookend the episode.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you see her waiting in line to give the gift to her, and you don't see their encounter either, because that would also be interesting. Like, what would that encounter be like?
Right. It's also weird
say?
That she isn't waiting in line with Tommy.
Right.
Which I guess, like, structurally, you don't want to spoil all the jokes that you get, because they make a lot of not good jokes, but like they get some comedy mileage off of Donald not knowing, you know, whose kid is who, how tall is your friend? Like, so if you have Tommy there, then that undercuts a lot of the jokes that are in the cold open.
Right.
But also it's like, okay, Tommy's mom, we're presumably they're spending this Christmas together, but she's also at Santa and he is not there. And right. He also is 11 at this point. Maybe he doesn't go see Santa if he's 11. Cause isn't he eight?
Oh, right. It's three years later, right?
Yeah. So maybe that's why. Maybe. But then also, don't you want to take your kid to go see the person that saved his Christmas?
Right.
Oh.
So
yeah, he's waiting to see what goes wrong, and it's very, very sad. Then we go and we get the scene between the other voice actor that's in this episode, which I don't know how big of a Pooh fan you are.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Right?
And,
like,
12 Angry Men as well.
Or
number two.
Bob Newhart show, Mr. Peterson is what I... So yeah, he's... John Fiedler is in this episode as, I'm assuming, like the principal of the boarding school. And he breaks it to Anne that he has bad news for Tommy. Because while Tommy is under the illusion that he's going home for Christmas, you know, the movie's done... They just got a call that those parents, they're still shooting.
I'm afraid I have some bad news for Tommy.
His parents aren't coming home for Christmas.
Well, how did you know?
Tommy said something might happen.
They're making a film. It's behind schedule.
That poor kid.
And Christmas, they're not coming home for Christmas. Also, I feel like there's got to be union laws against that. Right?
Yeah.
Like, working on a holiday.
Yeah. It's an odd little indie film.
Yeah. So in between that, we have another scene with Anne and another kid, Roger, who I wrote down in my notes. He's the bug kid with the big eyes.
Yep, big eyes. That's what that was my takeaway as well.
They're huge.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're almost upsettingly large eyes. He comes in and gives Anne his bug collection because I guess he can't take it home with him. And they have a nice little...
Which is weird because then we find out later that he lives like down the street.
Yeah, he lives literally just down the street and could have, could have probably left. Well, bug collection is also dead bugs. Couldn't he just leave them in his room? Maybe? Who knows?
Maybe he did that previously and that awful groundskeeper like just tossed them.
Yeah. The groundskeeper.
So he needs someone who can appreciate the bugs, and yeah.
Yeah. So Anne comes up with the first plan, and she's like, I'm going to take Tommy home to, like, be with my parents. She maybe does the mistake of telling Tommy all this before getting the okay.
Oh, yeah.
Which I also, like, Anne is very sweet. Like, if you only watch this episode, you come away with the impression that, like, Anne, her heart is the hugest heart of anyone's.
Yeah, she's very big-hearted, but she's also very young, and she, like, you know, yeah. And especially this is prior to season one, so she hasn't learned any of those lessons yet and forgotten them between
how
episodes.
How old do you think? So I don't even know how I should have looked up how old Marla Thomas is, but it, like, this takes place, that girl, she is young. Like, it seems like she is a young character. Like, it's a woman, like, her first, you know, flirtation with independence, and this is 3 years before that, but she already has some teaching certification of some sort. Like, maybe she doesn't...
So she did have some post high school schooling.
Yeah. Unless she is, I mean, yeah, I'm also trying to think if it's possible that she's like a volunteer at the boarding school, or like, you know, if she's like just helping out. But no, because they say, so she then goes, she's like, you're gonna come home with me, there's a lot of kids, you're gonna have a great time. But then she goes to John Fiedler and he's like, I'm sorry, but I can't, our insurance only covers, like, the children
have to be within a 10 mile radius of the school.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he can't, and even though, and she even says, like, but I'm a teacher, so like she is definitely like a teacher there, not like a so she's got to be in her mid-20s probably.
At that point, I would say younger than that.
Yeah, so...
I would say this is, like, her first professional thing out of
definitely,
college.
Definitely, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. And she has to go and tell him, like, you have to stay here. And he takes everything in such stride. I want to say that this little kid is such a good actor. Chris Shea is his name. He's such a good little... Because he projects this, like... there's like a resignation to his performance, and I'm saying this of like an 8-year-old, where he's like, you know what, like, I won't be alone, like, the groundskeeper will be here, I've done this before, And it's really crushing. And that's when Anne comes up with plan number two, which is she's going to stay with him. Which is where I have... I didn't say my favorite line of the episode, which is also what I referenced in the cold open. So when Anne is breaking the news to him, she says, like...
To be perfectly honest with you, I guess you could say it's bad.
You can't take me home with you. Is that it?
Yes.
You don't like me?
Oh, of course I like you. It's the insurance company.
They don't like me?
No, they like you.
That's maybe, like, my only laugh-out-loud moment of the episode. Like, I think that's such a funny, cute little moment.
Yes, it is. It's and he just so matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
Like, and because, like, once she says, you know, I've got some bad news, he's like, I'm not, oh, okay. I've been through this before in my young life.
And you sing a lot.
So now he's, like, going through it. So he's like, what is it? You don't like me?
Which you have to wonder, has he said that to his mother in previous years?
That... Definitely. Seems like the case.
Definitely. God. Yeah.
And also when he brings up the groundskeeper, I was like, oh, this is where Stephen King got The Shining from.
Yeah. There is a very... So two like larger notes about this episode that I think. So the first one being, I enjoy it when there is a level of creepiness to Christmas.
Okay.
Well, it's all because, not creepiness, but like... I do believe that Christmas is also a melancholy and a scary time. I think that Christmas is so beautiful because it is the melding of all of these very disparate traditions and religions and iconography all together, all at once, you know.
Yeah, it's a very postmodern understanding of Christmas as being, you know, it has that high suicide rate. It has, you know, a lot of people are very sad. You think about, and it, now it's a Thanksgiving movie, but Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Right.
Like, you know, there are people who, the holidays, it makes it very difficult. And plus you've got, you know, in modern times, we have an understanding of seasonal and disaffective disorder and stuff like that.
That's why the Charlie Brown Christmas special is so good, because it is from 1965 and it hits on all of those notes. You know,
much pressure for Christmas to be special and joyous. And as you get older and some of the magic of Christmas slips away, or where it gets, you know, a little bit harder to capture that. And, you know, you're sitting there with all of your gifts, and there can be this empty feeling that, you know, I got everything that I wanted, but that's not enough to fill this void in me. <Yeah. laughs>
Which is so beautiful. Like, I find it so beautiful how, and this is, I mean, I go on this, I've probably gone on this tear on this podcast before of like, I feel like that. I love Christmas, and I also have this weird, I feel like everyone should love Christmas, because the people that don't like Christmas cite those exact same reasons for not liking Christmas. And from my point of view, that is Christmas. So like, it's this weird thing of like, you should be happy about feeling sad at Christmas, because that's exactly what the holiday is. But it's
you have a complex palate for Christmas.
It involves
all of the bitter tones, not just the sweet ones.
And so I like when people are like, I'm not celebrating Christmas this year. I'm having a bad Christmas. I'm like, I want to give them a hug and be like, yeah, don't put up your tree. That's also how you do Christmas. Like, and so like, so that's also, this episode has so much of that in it. But then also the other thing that I wanted to talk largely about this episode is how it isn't funny.
No.
Which it's so interesting. It's a sitcom. It's a situation comedy. There is legit canned laughter, because this is from the era of sitcoms where they would shoot everything single cam and then force in laughter. The 70s is when they... So, like, 50s was all live in front of an audience. 60s was a reaction against that. And then 70s was a reaction against the reaction. So we're in the 60s version, where it's all single cam. And also, you could not imagine the show being shot on a soundstage. This is a very filmic episode. Like, it is in a very physical space that you couldn't recreate. And so there... It also feels... so dramatic but like gentle. It has an interesting tone that is not what you would think of a 60s sitcom, especially one called That Girl. Like,
yeah, there's you think, I don't know, Gumption, you think Sugar Plum Fairies, but no, this is a very sort of melancholy kind of
The Thanksgiving episode is that, because if you want hijinks, that's her running from house to house trying to make like two simultaneous Thanksgiving dinners for her parents and her future in-laws. And it is actually like, it's very funny, very charming. Marlo Thomas is great. This one is a somber affair, but is so sweet. I have written in my notes around this point, empathy with a giant heart. Because when she offers to stay, like, she has explained how great her Christmas is. She's like, she has a great relationship with her parents, which I think is also odd for a sitcom, especially one about like a single girl in the city. And she's like, there's gonna be all these kids, it's gonna be great. And then when she sees this one kid who's gonna have a bad Christmas, she's like, screw it, I'm staying with you. And it's so sweet. I love that so much.
You know, and we mentioned Taxi earlier, and I've been watching it lately, and there are some great episodes. Alex Rieger is one of my favorite sitcom protagonists.
Judd Hirsch.
It's very interesting because he, like, what is his character? His character is like a guy who is living a kind of lonely life, and at a thankless job, and yet all of his friends come to him for advice.
Yeah.
And they flirt with that a lot throughout the series. Particularly there's one where Lotka starts acting like Alex as one of his multiple personalities.
Yeah.
And they go see a therapist, and Lotka is as acting out and saying like, I understand now why I'm always like just trying to give people advice, and but I don't follow my own advice and all that stuff, and I figure out the secret. And then all of a sudden he loses that personality. He slips out of it. And Alex is like, but wait, what were you going to say? Like, what is your solution to, you know, my happiness? Like, what is your solution to me? And so I saw a little bit of that in Anne here, where it's a much different character, but and she's much younger, and
you don't really think Marlo Thomas and Judd Hirsch going up for the same parts,
almost, because like I like the fact that she has this energy for I want to solve this problem, but then she realizes gradually that I'm not helping, and maybe my intention wasn't entirely like, maybe part of the intention was selfish, because this is more about like, this kid might have been okay.
Yeah, he'd done it before. He wasn't
and he was, you know, kind of he was resigned to it. He was sad about it, but like, she created more of a problem for herself. Like, she selfishly wasn't thinking about her own happiness, which is a weird thing to say.
Anne is being so selfless, but as we see in a little bit, like, it does bring Tommy down, maybe lower than he would have been.
Because she, as you know, as a person who loves Christmas and puts a lot of importance and significance into Christmas, was ill-prepared to create that in a vacuum. Like, she was just like ill prepared to be sad about Christmas. So it's like, actually, by her being, you know, miserable, like, that also like brings it down for him too.
And it's all at the end of the act break is Anne has been also, I mean, maybe this sums it up, she's been promising like there's gonna be a great big snowfall on Christmas morning, like, you know, it's gonna be great. And then like the act ends with Tommy being like, oh look, it's getting dark, and then rain, and it's raining. And Anne says, how do you build a rain man? Which is, you cast Dustin Hoffman in 25 years. but, like, that's that. And so then we start up with the next act, and we're back in the department store. And so just to touch in of, like, hey, guys, this is a story. And so Donald's like, well, what did you do? And Anne was like, well, I found what worked, and then we just repeated it. We played 74 games of checkers, ate peanut butter sandwiches, and, like, redecorated the tree. And then we get this scene of them, like, they're decorating the tree for the umpteenth time.
And she's, like, moving things around the tree.
Yeah,
and, you know,
Tommy, he's straightening tinsel.
He's even making an effort to, like, when she says, oh, should I, you know, oh, you're not.
This isn't much fun for you, is it?
It's okay. I really enjoyed watching you move the angel around.
Shall I move the Santa around again?
We already moved that around a lot.
I love the idea also that when they play those 74 games of checkers, it's not all in a row. It's like a little bit for a while, and then they try the tree for a bit, and then they eat the sandwiches, and then they go. She's like, and then we'll go back to do the checkers. And like, it is such a, I don't know, insightful look at what depression is. Like,
you know, it really
find
is.
A couple of your different coping mechanisms, and you do a little bit at a time, and then you're like, and then you look forward to doing like, oh, and we'll do the checkers like, later, but we'll save it.
I like when they go. So like when she's like, "Were you hungry? Let's go down and eat." So they go down to eat peanut butter sandwiches for the dozenth time, probably. And I Marlo Thomas's performance in all this is so interesting. Yeah. I like, because she's like, "Do you want, like?" There's this sing-songy, like, unflappable positivity. And it's definitely like an act she's putting on, but she like goes down there and she's like, "Do you want?"
All righty. How do you want it? Cut in two or fold it over?
Cut in two.
Cut in two.
She's just trying so hard, and it's so nice. And there's a moment, like, she cuts the sandwich in half, he takes it and leaves, and then she, like, gets the knife out to cut hers in half, and then you see the crack a little bit of, like, I'm gonna fold it over. Like, you can see, like, she's maybe getting in a little bit to, like, or she's, like, taking a second of a break. Like, she can just fold it over. She doesn't have to do it. This is when we find out that the groundskeeper is also leaving, because I guess since Anne is there, he asked John Fiedler if he could go spend Christmas Eve with his brother. Or I guess this is actually the 23rd, because there's two nights in this episode. So this is like the evening of the 23rd.
Well, it's probably for multiple days that he's going to be gone.
Yeah. So he just like runs down like the list of like all the things you need to do, and then is like, see ya.
And then I'm like, again, thinking about The Shining, like, you know, you have this caretaker, and there's rules that ultimately amount to busy work,
yeah,
and routines, and that's exactly what, you know, that's exactly what Jack had to do in the Shining. And thinking about this big place, and like the furnace scene, like, I was like, Stephen King, like, even if he doesn't know that's where it came from, he must have watched this episode.
Definitely, and, like, stuck in the back of his head. She goes
and
down to
the
furnace.
And then it just, like, mutated into the shine.
Yeah, and a cat runs across her feet. Well, she goes down, and she's like, told me, check the furnace. Oh, check the furnace for what?
I like that she's talking to herself.
Yeah, and then a cat runs across her feet, and she's like, nope, out. The use of space in this episode, this is one, like, this is such a huge, I mean, again, I don't know where they shot it, I don't know, like, how big the space actually was, but, like, the angles they use, there's a lot of wide shots.
Yeah.
I'm getting to, like, even the scene in the gym, so again, John Ehrman did a really good job here, like, it's shot from up high in a way. Like, they're really doing a good job of showing how big the space is and also how empty. Because right after the furnace scene, she runs back upstairs to them, like, she's terrified. And
is like, I'll read you a bedtime story. And he's like, I'm kind of just going to sleep, but okay, cool. And and he realizes too that she's just scared herself,
yeah,
and she doesn't want to be alone. And so she sleeps in the neighboring bunk bed.
Yeah, it's really nice. So then the next morning, we like dissolve to the next morning where she's on the phone with, I think, her dad. And she's like, oh, yeah, no, he's playing in the gym. And then she hears, like, a little bit of a commotion, but she hears that the commotion, like, she's not scared. It's not like this, like, oh, my God, there's an intruder. She's like, oh, wait, there's something good going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think she hears that it's, like, another kid. And so it's Roger, the bug kid. And they are playing in an old-ass gym, which is what I wrote down. Like, they are, like,
it's like this gym would have a medicine ball.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there are. Like, they get on a thing, which I guess is what was a treadmill in the 60s.
An analog treadmill, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like the abacus version of a treadmill. Like, it actually looks like an abacus that is a treadmill, because it's a whole bunch of little rolling pins.
And it's not even, like, kid size. It's just, like, I don't know. This is something that, I don't know, some place went out of business, and they were like, hey, we'll give it to the boarding school, and the kids can use it.
Yeah, because it looks even older than the 60s. Like, it's all wooden, and... But this leads to a really quick montage of, like, them shooting basketball, and then them doing, like, follow the leader. And I love this scene so much, because it is just these two kids who are definitely, like, 7 or 8, and they are being aggressively 7 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they do follow the leader, which is like, you know,
seven
around
or eight in the 60s, I should say.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, stand on the chair, touch the ornament, crawl under this, sit down. And like the two kids, they get to the point, like the joke is like, sit on the chair, sit on the chair, sit on the chair. Oh, I have to go. Oh, I have to go. Oh, I have to go. And at that point is where I'm sure the script was like, oh, well, now the two kids will then have a dialogue about, you know, oh, don't go. We're having fun. But these two little kid actors scream their lines.
On the chair, on the chair.
I have to go home.
No, I really got to go home. It's late. Oh, come on, Roger. One more game. Come on. I need a Tony.
All right.
I need a Tony.
Roger, really have to go home. Okay, now we'll walk right through the door. Come on, Tom.
Man, it sure was fun, wasn't it? Yeah, that was a blast.
Yeah.
Which mm-hmm. I find so, like, real and charming. Like, Linus, like, starts tickling the other kid. And he's like, no, you can't go. We're having a good time. And it's so like quick and like chaotic, and you can also see that like Marlo Thomas is playing like so exhausted.
Right.
It's such a good little scene, and I like it a lot.
It's very bittersweet because it's so simple, and like this is all it takes to keep this kid engaged. And for a part of the episode, I was sure that the other kid was dead.
It was like a ghost. The Shining like, thing just, has come.
Like, yeah, it was like, yeah, I guess I'm stuck in that.
Didn't you hear? He died because he gave up his bugs.
Yeah, and we just found out he's just like a weird kid, and he's Jewish, and that's it. That's like, yeah, he doesn't have Christmas, but like he hangs out. So basically his thing is he goes to this boarding school, and I guess he stays there during the semester or whatever, but
even though he lives
on holidays, he goes back home, which is like down the street, down the block or whatever. But on the weekends, he works out in the gym, yeah. Like hangs there, presumably alone. But also, it's kind of curious because if Linus spent the time there last year, why didn't he see the kid?
Oh, well, maybe the kid's a new. Maybe this is his first Christmas season.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe, you know. Maybe that explains why he's so creepy and collects bugs. He moved to a new place and was like, what's my thing going to be? Oh, it's going to be Bug Kid. Choose wiser. So this is where, like, after he leaves is where the depression hits Tommy again. And he's kind of like, I'm just going to go upstairs and study comics. And this is where Anne has the revelation that, honestly, I cried real tears watching this this morning at this point. Because Anne realizes that, like, he needs to be with a family. Like, mm-hmm. her selfless act doesn't solve what he needs, which is he needs, you know, parents, kids, like, he needs that. She can't give that to him, but she can because she can. She calls Roger's parents and is like, hey, would you guys mind having Tommy for Christmas? Which totally, like, sacrifices her, like, so he goes over there, he's so excited, and he's like, oh, but you're gonna have to spend Christmas alone. And that's when I started, like, I just love this moment so much. Mm-hmm. She has to stay because she has to do all this, like, maintenance caretaker stuff. She can't go. And also, like, she doesn't need to be there. What he needs is this family. So she isn't. And she gives up. She gives up her Christmas for him. And right. Then the act ends with her. She grabs the angel. She turns off the television. She grabs the treetopper angel and then just says to herself,
just one night, one Christmas. I'm not a kid anymore.
Blackout. Yeah. Like, fade to black.
Yeah. And it's sort of like she's the one who feels it more deeply because she's had Christmases.
Yeah.
he's like, it's a big mystery for him. And obviously he's a kid and he's alone, so it's sad. But like, he hasn't had like something to compare it to,
right,
other than having Christmases in like a hotel.
Hotels, like, and
he's had that before,
yeah,
you know. But for her, like, she's, and that's sort of the thing is, and then that's like the kind of the I don't want to say the danger, or like that's the dark secret of Christmas, is that it becomes so difficult because if you grew up celebrating Christmas every year, you've built it up in your mind as,
right,
this thing. And obviously as an adult, you can never like recapture that,
no,
unless you're able to view it through the lens of kids. Like if you're able to share that experience with like your own kids, or,
mm-hmm,
you know, or if you give, you know, gift to somebody else, like it's like it, you can't reclaim the feeling of, oh my God, look at all these presents, it's great. You have to just empathize with someone else.
Yeah. And it just, I think it's just such a beautiful moment. That sacrifice, that Christmas sacrifice,
mm-hmm,
which is also what makes, like, that makes this such a good Christmas episode to me, is that, that selflessness. Ugh. So I just, yeah.
I think it's like deceptively a very Christmassy Christmas episode with a very Christmas message to it.
Yeah.
But it's like it's very non-traditional in the sense that it's about loneliness. It's about like the realities of Christmas, and it's not jam-packed with like you know.
It's,
yes,
not like
it
a
does.
Family Matters one where it's like Santa's real, here's your perfect gift, here's a surprise snowfall, here's,
which is maybe why it does behoove them to have, you know, the bookends of her being the Christmas elf
with
Santa, and like, so you have some semblance of the traditional,
what,
you know, Christmas and the, you know, the commercialism of it and everything and all the iconography of it. And that helps both make it a Christmas make it qualify as a Christmas episode, but then also it's a great contrast to this story from 3 years ago where, you know, it was about the lack of Christmas.
Yeah.
The sacrificing a Christmas so that someone else could have it.
Oh, which is my kind of story. I love. The next morning, so Christmas morning, so the fades out, commercials play, get some ads for like cigarettes and Monopoly. I don't know. It's 1966.
Shampoo.
And we come back up and it's Christmas morning. Marie's like, she's rebounded. She's on the phone with her dad. She's like, no, yeah. And then Tommy comes back while she's on the phone and he is just like, he says, thanks for getting me invited, which is so, I don't know. I don't know why that line strikes me as so funny. I think it's a little bit formal. It's like, thanks for getting me invited over there. It's mm-hmm, a little bit, I think it's so precocious and like fun. And then they, like, he says, no, they didn't have a Christmas tree. They're Jewish. And he has, and you know, it's the best Christmas ever, but the fact that they're Jewish also makes it so much sweeter in that, like, he's like, they celebrated Christmas just for me. And I, again, like, cue the tears again. It's like everyone is great except for the, I don't know why Roger's parents make him go to a boarding school if he literally just lives a walking distance away.
Right.
Maybe he doesn't stay overnight. Maybe. I don't know. But yeah, it's like the episode ends with like everyone except for Tommy's parents is great. Like, I'm so glad that the neighbors, the Rogers family, gave him a great Christmas and he's so happy. And, you know, I'm glad that, you know, Anne bounced back. She gets to spend some of Christmas Day with Tommy. It's good.
Maybe Rogers' parents work nights. And
maybe
they're not there. And so, like, I don't know.
Maybe they're like, maybe his dad's a senator or like something.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, a traveling job. And then the episode ends with we're back in the department store and it's like, that was that Christmas. And then Santa's dealing with a crying kid and Anne's like, I gotta go, I'm Santa's helper, and that's it.
Yeah, it ends on a crying child because like they also don't resolve that they fade to black. Like, the kid is crying through that.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's about the gritty realities of Christmas.
Yeah, and that is our magical Christmas tale. Are you ready for some must-have facts about this episode?
I, I hope so.
Oh my God. Yeah, get ready. It's going to blow your light.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So the ratings for this, who knows? That Girl was never in the top 30 for all five of its seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is kind of crazy that it was what never was a top 30 show.
You know what it was going up against?
The top five shows of this TV season, the 1966 to 67 season, was number five, The Jackie Gleason Show, four, The Lucy Show, three, The Andy Griffith Show, two, The Red Skelton Hour, and the number one show was Bonanza.
Okay.
So yeah. I think earlier you said like That Girl was a little ahead of its time, and I think, yeah, you compare it to those shows, I think it is ahead of its time.
And if other episodes are similar to this one, I think, and memory serves that, I don't want to say that it's like challenging television, but they were going for something else, and it wasn't necessarily feel good all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it would be fascinating to see, you know, some of the mass opinion on That Girl. Like, did they deem this as like, oh, she's, you know, sinful, you know?
Yeah, like, is like, where, I mean, like, it's weird, you know, she's in New York City. This is also an era of very rural television, because this is the big rural wave of Beverly Hillbillies and Andy Griffith Show is very much late 60s. Mary Tyler Moore is a reaction to that. So That Girl's like this weird outlier of like, she's a single, there's no kids in it. And then the episode where there is a kid in it, the parents abandon the kid. So I could see where, like, this is not family viewing. So the ABC Thursday night lineup that this aired as part of is a night of TV that I would die for. So it started off with Batman 66.
Okay.
Followed by F Troop, Bewitched, That Girl, some show called Love on a Rooftop, and then ABC Stage 67, which was a weekly anthology drama. Every week, a new hour-long story.
Oh, wow.
But, like, Batman, F-Troop, Bewitched, and That Girl, I'm on board. Also, bizarre lineup.
That is crazy. I mean, I was thinking about it, you know, earlier this year, just that, like, the fact that there was a wave of, like, hillbilly shows, like people were fascinated with rural America, and like a backwards version of that, that's like, and I'm just trying to imagine, you know, now, like, it's, that's crazy.
And like, so that's like, so you have a pop art superhero show followed by F Troop, which is like a Wild West sitcom, then Bewitched, social allegories about racism through hokey witchcraft, like, and then That Girl, a very grounded take on like single life or like young life in the city.
I would say, you know, that like it's very mixed there, but like if there was an odd one out, it would be That Girl.
Oh, definitely, because I mean Batman and Bewitched, I can see that they
sure.
And then like F Troop is also goofy as hell and also a high premise,
right?
It's very weird. So this episode was written by James L. Brooks, and this is where I will talk about how, this is a sitcom episode that has a sequel, which I find fascinating on a different show. Do you know all this? Have you heard about this?
No.
So James L. Brooks, after That Girl Ends, he co-creates Mary Tyler Moore Show with Alan Burns. Okay. And the season one Mary Tyler Moore episode from 1970 is called Christmas and the Hard Luck Kid 2. So
they actually put a 2?
Yes.
Okay.
And so that episode is Mary is like super excited about going home for Christmas. And we did it on the podcast last year, and I talked about it with Megan O'Keefe. So everyone go back and listen to that. So she has to work on Christmas. She thinks she's going to go home on Christmas. And Lewis would be like, you know, the news, like, you're going to have to work on Christmas. And she's like, okay, well, I'll have Christmas Eve then. And then, like, the morning of Christmas, and, like, she plans with Rhoda of, like, cool, we'll have Christmas Eve, we'll swap gifts, and then I'll go to work on Christmas, but it'll be fine. But then, day before Christmas Eve, or Christmas Eve rolls around, and one of her coworkers is like, actually, I never get to have Christmas with my kids, but you don't have kids. Can you work on Christmas Eve? And then she's like, ugh, okay, I can't, like, not let you not have Christmas with your kids. So then she volunteers to work on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So she goes home and has like a 20-minute Christmas with Rhoda, and then she goes and then spends Christmas by herself in the office. And that episode also like guts me every year
so
too.
So she is the hard luck kid.
She is, but also like again, she is. There are so many similar themes of, you know, both Anne Marie and Mary Richards are very like looking forward to this Christmas that then they then sacrifice so that a kid can like have Christmas with a family. And then they have to spend, and they both have these like moments of loneliness. These like, they both of them get these scenes where they're just like in a space being alone. And it's really interesting. On IMDb, 36 users rated this a 6.8 out of 10.
Okay.
Higher, lower, or on the money. Upsettingly low. These 36 users are Scrooges that I want to debate. No,
I think these people are very limited in their understanding of what a Christmas episode can be.
Yeah. Also, 36 users is not a lot. So it's a small sample size.
Right.
I have no idea how this compares to their opinion of all the other That Girl episodes.
I also just think it's interesting that they took the time to review it. Like an episode of That Girl, and
yeah.
Do you review things on IMDb?
No,
or like,
so there used to be a website called TV.com.
Yeah.
And so this was in college. After I watch every episode, I would go, and you could rate things on a scale of 1 to 10. So I would do that after I am crazy, and I have an app called TV Time on my phone currently that I do a similar thing with.
I don't think that's crazy. At least it's fortunate that you got the job that you did.
Yeah,
and
that's
that
also
makes
partly
it not crazy anymore.
That's partly why I do it, because I have to think about and cover so much television that I need actually something to tell me, like, when are things coming out? What have I watched?
Sure,
like, etc. So, work expense. This free app.
If you didn't have this job and you still did that, then that might be kind of, I would say, eccentric at least.
Yeah.
But that's okay. Eccentric's good.
I mean, yeah. I would give this episode a fucking like 9.7. Like that's
wow.
Me. Like that's where I would go. That's where my head is at.
I'm gonna say a 7.5.
Okay.
I think it's interesting. I think, but in terms of entertainment value, it's not one that I would necessarily revisit a bunch.
Right.
I think it's a little. I mean, it's I don't want to say it's like. I don't want to say it's like Antichrist, where like I watched and I'm glad that I had seen it once. And, you know, I have the experience and I have no plans on watching it again. I think there's a gulf there
between
those things. So, I enjoyed it and I thought it was very thoughtful, especially given the time.
Right. That is the thing that I like. You can't, and I guess this might be why you give it a 6.8 if you're an IMDb idiot. That was way too harsh. Is if you go into this expecting to laugh. Which I understand is a reasonable expectation, considering this is a situation comedy. You're not gonna get it. It's just, I think the tone of it is not what anyone would ever expect, and it's why
it's like with so at the garage we watch a lot of sitcoms, we watch Hulu and stuff like that, and Netflix, and even before then we would have DVDs down there, and we had MASH, and my dad would like to watch MASH from the beginning, but then stop at a certain point. Because then, as he considers it, you know, Alan Alda gets his fingers in too much of it, and it becomes much more of a morality thing, and you know, it gets like psychological, and you know, and very sort of odd and somber, and so he just wants the slapstick,
exactly,
and, you know, and that's fine, and I think that's totally fine. I like a little bit of both. That's why one of my favorite shows is Taxi, because I think it has a really nice ratio, a really unusual ratio of, I think there's some really sharp comedy in there, but also some Reverend Jim, it's like, it's very sad stuff. And like, these are people who are leading sort of miserable lives, and it's a very grimy, dirty kind of show. I think the comedy is great, but you know, and you know, so like That Girl, I think they're doing that there, but it's like, it's even more unexpected
because it still has the veneer. Kind of,
well, like if you, but yeah, because yeah. If you look at, you know, if you look at MASH, you know, you're actually more, I think, taken aback when it is comical, and like, oh, it's about war. It's about, it's, you know, it's about Korea and Vietnam, and it's like, you would expect it to be melancholy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Taxi, like, these people are, you would expect it to be kind of sad and humdrum, you know, based on the themes that they're dealing with. And so with like, but with That Girl, you'd think, oh, it's going to be this effervescent thing. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand where people are like, oh, the That Girl Christmas episode must be like so bubbly and bright and festive. And so when it's not, I can see that being off-putting. But also, I think that's kind of that's unfortunate because they were trying something.
Yeah, and the season two Christmas episode is that, like, it is a hijinks episode. So who would you say had the must see performance in this episode?
I liked.
There's really only two choices, I guess, unless you go with Bug Kid.
Bug Kid was pretty good.
He was.
I like how phoned in the groundskeeper is. I like that he's just like, I am just a groundskeeper. I am not in a Christmas episode. Hit the button. You probably won't die. I'll see you next week. I kind of like that.
Good.
Donald is my answer.
Definitely not Donald. I will definitely say Chris Shea as Tommy, not Linus, just because you must see what Linus looks like and actually see that voice coming out of a face. Like, it's so jarring, but in a great way.
Yes.
Also, saying the phrase, a voice coming out of a face, very unsettling. And finally,
that is a very complex role for a kid.
Yes.
In this era as well.
Yeah. Finally, must other people see this episode, especially in the next, like, week before Christmas?
Yes, of course.
Yes,
This is a very unique Christmas episode.
Especially for a show that, so like, no one talks about That Girl. It has kind of been lost to the sands of time. But I also think if you've never seen That Girl, you can just watch this episode. It is kind of the definition of a standalone episode, mainly because the entire episode is her telling a story about a status quo that does not exist within the context of the.
And it's like a Twilight Zone episode that inspired The Shining.
Yeah.
I'm convinced.
Yeah, I definitely see it. I think that's also why I like it. And you know what? Shining is more of a Christmas movie than Die Hard. Boom. That's a whole other thing.
I heartily agree.
Yeah. So where can people find you on the internet, find all the things that you want people to find of yours?
I'm just on Twitter as a Fuzzy Typewriter. Maybe we'll bring back the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast someday, who knows, but there's a big horizon out there, and we don't know, but and then I mentioned themarginscomic.com. You can also find that and the Dreadnought book on Comixology for pretty cheap. So check those out.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming by and getting your Christmas cheer on.
Thank you.
This lovely time of year. And Merry Christmas to all the listeners out there that celebrated. Happy holidays as well.
Jingle jangle.
And that does it for this year on Must Have Seen TV. Thanks again to my guest this week, Paul Montgomery, for dropping by and talking about That Girl and Christmas with me.
Next year, I will be talking about even more shows from the 20th century, hopefully on a much more regular basis. I promise. I promise? Yeah, I'll promise. Thanks to everyone for listening all year, and keep spreading the word. Tell people, keep listening, go back and listen to old episodes. Why not? And until we come back with a new episode, I say we, even though it is just myself. I want to hear from all of y'all by, you know, you can tweet me and at MustHaveSeenTV. You can email MustHaveSeenTV@gmail.com. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at MustHaveSeenTV. And if you like what we've heard, give me the Christmas gift of an iTunes review. The theme song is Patricia's Moving Picture by The Go Team. Thanks to Acast for hosting the podcast. Thanks to all y'all for listening, and I will see y'all next year. A MustHaveSeenTV.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.